Welcome to TFP, the Theater Folk Podcast, the place to be for drama teachers, drama students, and theater educators everywhere. I'm Lindsay Price, resident playwright for Theater Folk. Hello. I hope you're well. Thanks for listening. You have reached episode 162, and you can find any links to this episode in the show notes, which are at theaterfolk.com/episode162. So, it's summertime. Everyone is taking it easy. Maybe going to the beach. Maybe going camping, doing a little bit of travel. It's kind of funny because, funny for me, maybe funny for no one else on the planet. But here at TFolk Global Headquarters, summer is the time when we travel the least. We do it so much for work during the year, and then if we're going to choose when we go away for a vacation, it's going to be in May, because May is the month that nobody wants to hear from us or talk to us, because everything is winding down, and once June, July, people are starting to get all into their year again, but May is dead. So it's perfect for travel. But enough about me. Let's get into the podcast and the question of the podcast, which is, how do you successfully, without heartburn and heartache, travel with a group of students? How do you plan and implement trips to, say, New York or London? You want to take your theater students to New York, to Broadway, to, you know, see the sights, see the shows. We have a teacher, Lisa Houston, who is a pro at traveling with students, and she is here to give you tips, tricks, and she's even got a post-trip reflection students can do. I know! All right, let's get to it. All right, I am here with Lisa Houston. Hello, Lisa.
Hi, how are you?
I'm all right. Tell everybody where you are in the world.
I am in Pennington, New Jersey, which is a small town outside of Princeton, New Jersey. And we are sort of halfway between New York and Philadelphia.
Ooh, okay. I like it when it's always interesting to me when people say where they are. And in my head, I'm like, I have no idea where that is. But your visual was perfect.
Good.
And how long have you been a teacher?
I have been a teacher. This is my 20th year of being a teacher, and I've been at Pennington actually all of those years. So
wow. Okay, yeah. So that's you're dug in.
I am. I'm here to stay.
Oh, that's awesome.
Hopefully.
So, what is it about being a teacher, being a drama teacher, that connects to you?
Well, I love creative projects, first of all. So, you know, doing drama is always a creative project, whether it's just something small in class, a small scene, or even a page of dialogue. And then, of course, staging shows is a passion of mine. Like, I just love creating worlds and following through with that.
Cool. I love that. I love that notion it must be, what a wonderful thing to pass on to your students, that this is what one of the things we get to do is to create a world.
Yes. Yes.
Very cool. So we're going to talk about something a little bit different, but I know that this is a topic that is of great interest to a lot of our listeners. It's something that it happens with the drama students, but happens outside of the classroom, and that is traveling with your students. I know a lot of teachers who take their take students to New York, and you traveled a little farther afield than that. You went to London.
Right. So New York for us is just a day trip, so we don't get to
backyard.
Yeah, that's our normal jam. But so we just came back from a 10-day trip to London, and we also went outside of the city and paired up with a school. So, ooh. Yeah, so we got to sort of do two things in one, which was awesome.
Okay, so let's go through this whole thing about what it's like. And how many students did you take?
We took 24 students and 4 chaperones. So our school has a pretty well-established global studies program. Mm. So in that respect, for us, it's easy to travel. We have sort of a cosmopolitan like the families at our school travel often, and so it's sort of a belief of our school. I know a lot of other teachers in the States don't always have that backing from their administration, but our school, we do have that backing, and we have sort of a system in place for proposing trips and taking trips. So we have a ratio of 6 students to 1 adult. So we had to take 4 chaperones.
Cool. So
with our 24 students.
Let's back up just a little bit. So let's talk about that notion of the importance of trips like this. And like for someone who might not have administrative backing, why do you feel it's important for your students to travel?
I think like more than ever, especially with the world as it is right now. And in some ways, the world hasn't really changed. It's just how much attention we're putting on events like bombings and things that has changed over the years. Like there's always been sort of violence and uncertainty in the world. We're just sort of getting it as more immediate information and constant information. So I don't actually think the world has changed that much. And I think there is a huge value in seeing another culture.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I really agree with you that I'm not sure that this world is more violent than past. We just know about it.
Yeah, we get to see it immediately unfolding. So that's a difference. But I think that we're asking students more and more to be connected, to learn how to be responsible users of technology and gather information from all over the world and all these sources. And then we're like afraid to leave our own town, you know, so it's sort of we're setting them up like to be these global citizens. And then I think, you know, parents and administrators sometimes have this fear of like what might happen or something. And so I think that you can't really understand life until you put yourself in a different culture, in a different set of expectations, even a different language. I mean, our trip didn't involve a different language per se, but there are definitely differences in British language and how they use words that were challenging to our students. You know, learning even something simple like a crisp versus a chip. You know, like that's important to know when you're ordering in a restaurant. So I think it's important to sort of put yourself in someone else's shoes.
I really like that. And I like too that you're, you know, if you really want to, you know, get into what your administration wants, they want, in theory, this is what they say, that whole notion of critical thinkers and that global thinking, I think is very clear on a lot of the curriculum that's what today's students are supposed to be. And I think travel is one of my favorite things for that pure reason of even the ordinary. I think the ordinary part of travel is actually more interesting to me sometimes than the spectacle of travel.
Right.
Knowing the difference between a crisp and a chip. I love
that.
Okay. So let's start on, what's your timeline when you're planning a trip? Like, what is your, when do you, like, announce that, what's your first step in terms of announcing when a trip is going to happen? What's your timeline?
I think you need about a year, maybe a little bit less than a year, but you need a good, like, 9 months to really set everything up. So we would usually announce our trips in, like, May or June for the following year. So this particular trip happened in March. We've done some trips over to the Fringe Festival that were more of like a August, you know, August departure time. So we had,
the Edinburgh Fringe Festival.
Yeah. The Edinburgh Fringe Festival, through the World Strides programs. So that was a little different, but for this trip, we left ourselves about 9 months to do all of the planning. So we would announce the trip in May or June, sort of get solid deposits in September. And we would start with our travel agent booking, you know, hotel, the tube passes that we got, all of the coach transportation, and our flights. We started booking in, you know, late September once we had all the deposits in.
So that, I think that's pretty important to note, that your timeline starts really early.
Yes, you need a lot of time.
And that you're not doing it alone. You're working with somebody else to
Right. So what we've done with these trips to London is that we do use a travel agent, a local travel agent, to book sort of the bigger things so we can get better pricing and group rates and things like that. And then we do all of the booking for the museum entrances and shows that we're seeing and backstage tours and workshops. So that we're doing on our own because we want total control of what our kids are seeing, and we want to pick where we're going and the order we're going in and the types of shows we're seeing and which backstage tours we want to go to. So we do all of that ourselves, which means a lot of phone calls, a lot of emails back and forth to people in England, which is on a different time zone. So that alone, you know, I started working on that in, I guess I would say October. It was hard to start booking anything before October because a lot of the organizations, like the Globe, doesn't even book their workshops. You know, they only book them, I think, 6 or 8 weeks in advance.
Oh,
so
wow.
so like some of it you're doing far ahead, and then some of it will come closer to when you're departing on the trip.
And I that's really interesting, and I think that's a good thing to get out there, is because we know there are lots of companies that sort of are all in. If you go to, if any of you are thespian groups out there and you go to your thespian festivals or international thespian festival, that's a big thing, is that there are tour companies who and I know a couple of them quite well, and that they are the ones who do everything. So that's interesting to note, to put out there, that that's not necessarily the way you have to go.
Yeah, you don't have to go that way, but you can.
You can.
And I think it's a great option for somebody maybe doing it for the first time. There's definite benefits to when we've traveled under World Strides versus this trip that we were putting together ourselves. But I think there's a lot of benefits to you sort of calling the shots of what your students are seeing, because you can tailor make the trip to the interests of the kids that you have. So our trip was art and theater related. So we had some photographers with us and painters and architects alongside technical theater kids and actors and performers. And that made it really rich and interesting that we could go and see all these things and have all these different perspectives.
When you were planning your trip, did you just knew who the students were? Did you like talk to them and see what kind of things they want to do? Did you use your past experience on trips? So, like, when you are thinking of your itinerary, what's your thought process on picking and choosing? Like, what are, you know, are you always like, we always must have, you know, a backstage tour, you know, or like, what's your thought process on getting that itinerary down?
Sure. We do know our students well, and a lot of them we've taught even since middle school. So we sort of, you know, have our, I think most drama teachers know their students really well.
Yeah.
So I think it's like a must see when you're in London to go to a few different places. Like, I think the National Theatre is a treasure that we don't really necessarily have in America. And so you want to go to the National Theatre and you want to go on their tour and you want to see, you know, one, if not more things there, because they do so many shows in rep. You can usually see a few things there in the span of a week. And I just think the space is important, that they have a sort of this dedicated public space. So we made sure we ate meals there, that we sort of used that as like a meeting point on one of the days. So I think the National Theater for us was like a must-see, and I just knew that a lot of the kids in the group would appreciate that space. And I think the Globe does a great job with their education. So, there's some things that are just my personal opinion. Like, I think these are must-see places. And then the art teacher had some of her own, you know, like, she really wanted us to go to the Victoria and Albert Museum. So I think if you know your kids, you can sort of piece out. Like, if I had had more musical theater kids with me, I might have seen different shows or done different things. But based on my population, I sort of made some calls and decisions, you know, maybe more straight plays than musicals, or, you know, we saw Shakespeare, but there may be some groups that I wouldn't take to a Shakespeare. So I think if you know your kids, you're going to sort of get a sense of what you want to see. And then I did a lot of reading. Like, I did a lot of reading online of what was popular, what was getting good reviews, you know, because I'm not in England all the time, so I don't know. You know, I have a good sense of what's on in New York and what's getting good reviews and what would be a must-see in New York, but I had to sort of do that research myself for England.
Okay, so I think that's a really interesting thing. Like, you want to make the trip the best that it can be for the students, right?
Right.
At the end of the day, it's the thing that they're going to remember. When you are traveling with students, what are the guidelines that you have with just traveling with a number amount of students? Everybody's, you know, like, passports have to be had, you know, everyone's got to have currency. What are some of your guidelines for just the traveling with that many students?
Sure. We have some guidelines that are in place through school, but we have a pretty strict behavior contract that they have to fill out. And then we make sure that we have meetings with the parents before we leave on the trip. And we usually actually get to meet with the parents often because we do fundraising. So, and I think the fundraising is an important part of it to build sort of the group spirit and get the parents on board and everyone feels like they're sort of invested in the trip. So we do have some parent meetings with where we spell out our expectations. We make sure that they're getting the kids the right type of, you know, credit cards or debit cards and, that they have all their passports taken care of. We actually had some international students with us who then needed visas. So we had to go through that process with them. And we keep a copy of everyone's passport with us. And we also take the kids' passports from them when we arrive in the country and we hold them in the safe, you know, at the hotel. Because nowadays you don't need your passport really to trade money, so we take the passports. It used to be harder to do that when they would need them, you know, kind of constantly throughout the trip, but we did all of our money exchange at the airport, like right when we got off the plane, made sure everyone had their money, and then we did another money exchange like later in the week for people who had spent their spending money and needed to exchange more money. But for the most part, kids these days are drawing money out of bank machines. So you just have to make sure with the guidelines of the country that you're traveling to, like which bank cards work, and some bank cards don't work. So we're able to sort of caution people against certain things and make sure they're all squared away with funding. And then the passport, you just want to keep under lock and key. And then we sort of broke our group into four groups with a chaperone in charge. And we always do that when we travel. So whether it's by grade or by group, in this case, it was by like the speed of walking. So the fast walkers went with one chaperone. And then sort of the medium walkers went with two others. And I was super slow because I was coming out of having an illness. So the slower walkers were with me. And that way, whenever we got to like a tube station or got off the tube or on the tube, I was only tracking six people. So that, you know, I would say like my group's here. And then we would make sure all four groups were accounted for. And then we would move forward. So the kids got really good at like stepping off the tube and getting against the wall. Or, you know, you want to pick landmarks and make sure they understand like the meeting time and the meeting place, a lot of repetitive information so that kids are really aware of their surroundings and can meet up if they get lost. And we also were never allowed to be alone, and they actually had to always be in a group of three. So that way, if there was an issue, some kind of medical issue or something, you know, you always had someone to stay with maybe the person who was hurt and then another person to go get help. So we always make them be in groups of three, and they had very little time when they weren't with an adult.
Yeah.
So we keep them really with us under lock and key. And that is something that I think has changed in the past 20 years. So when I used to run trips before I had my own children, it was very different. Like, you could set children free in London with a map, and they knew how to read the map and they knew sort of how to be aware. But I think with sort of helicoptering, with like post 9/11, I think it's a really different vibe with parents and students. Like, the students don't feel comfortable without being near an adult. So that was a big shift for me, like thinking about how I used to run these trips and then how I'm running this trip in 2016 is a little different.
Well, you know, that's, yeah. And that's good to know too. I mean, you have to, it's all about the students. You have to adapt to what your students, you know, your students want. It may be one thing to feel, well, you know, it's important to let them off on their own. And it's like, but what if that's not the thing that's going to make their experience great?
And they're like, they were not comfortable with that. And also the parents weren't comfortable. Like, it was obvious through our meetings with the parents that they didn't want them having free time and being off on their own. And part of my philosophy with traveling with teenagers is, like, you don't give them much free time. You may give them choices where, okay, this group's going to Camden Market to shop, and this group's going to a museum, and this group's going here, but you don't want to give them free time, because when you give them free time is when bad things happen. So people lose their backpacks, or people drink, or do something that you don't want to have happen, and chaos ensues. So we kept them on a really tight schedule, but a flexible schedule, like a schedule we could all look at and say, you know what, we're not going to a museum tomorrow morning. We're going to let them sleep in, and we'll go to breakfast later, and we'll get started later. Like, they need catch-up time. Or one morning we had something planned, and we decided to do a choice where each chaperone was going to a different place. So you want to have a full schedule, but a flexible schedule.
I think that's really important. I really like that. I like that notion of flexibility in your schedule, that whole notion of just don't give them free time, making sure they're always in a group, and, you know, making sure that groups are it's basically little self-contained groups instead of all 24 of you sort of milling around at once.
Right.
You know, there's lots of really, really great tips there. Let's talk about, let's go two more things. How do you deal with, because I'm sure that this is all, you've done this for so many years, you know your students, and all, you know, a lot of it, for the most part, I'm sure works like clockwork. But how do you deal with, when you're on the trip, and it's not the same thing as, you know, sending a kid home on a bus, but when there is an issue or there is something that doesn't go like clockwork, you know, what's been an experience that where you've been in a position that it hasn't worked out and
right.
You've had to deal with that?
So this trip was really smooth. We've had in the past a medical issue. So we had a sprained ankle on one of our trips. So I had to go to the hospital. So I guess the important thing to remember is that you want to be contacting the child's parents and also your school administrators. You want to keep your administrators informed. And I sort of used their protocol as my protocol, if that makes sense.
Example of their protocol that you used?
So our school protocol is always that we have an administrator on duty because we have some boarding students here on campus along with day students. So you would always want to call the administrator on duty first, no matter what the emergency is, like even if someone's calling 911 at the same time. So what we did in that circumstance when we had to take Allison to the hospital is we had to make sure our administrator on campus knew that we were doing that. And that her parent was informed that we were doing that also. And then we had all the paperwork behind us to sort of, you know, all the medical paperwork that we needed to have consent for treatment and things like that. Other sort of weird circumstances, you know, we've had kids who, on this trip, actually, we had a girl who her parents, for some reason, thought maybe she didn't want to be on the trip anymore. So I'm not sure exactly what she communicated home. But it used to be that, like, you took kids abroad and they didn't talk to their parents for 10 days. You know, like, they didn't call home and they didn't have cell phones. And they really had that experience of being away from their parents. Does that...
Yeah.
You understand what I mean? But nowadays, like, most of them had working phones. Most of them were texting their parents constantly. And so we had an incident where she had maybe said, like, I'm exhausted, I'm not having fun, or... felt, I don't know, I don't really, we couldn't get to the bottom of it, but I had to have a conversation with both of her parents who were divorced. So I made sure I talked to mom and I talked to dad and I met with the girl. And then, you know, I sat with her while she talked to her mom and then she had to talk to her dad. And it was established that, like, she was tired. She had said something maybe she didn't mean. She did want to stay. You know, we were doing a show at a school, like, she wanted to be in the show. And so then once her parents talked to her, that was sort of established. We haven't really had behavioral issues on our trips because we just have a level of trust with our students. Like, they know we expect a lot and we treat them with respect and they sort of respect our program. And so we haven't really had kids, you know, try to go off and get drunk or because they're 18, like, think they can have a beer at a pub. Like, we haven't really had that issue. There have been some other trips at our school that have had that issue. And, you know, our policy as a school is that the student is sent home at the expense of the parent. So, like, we have had that and had to deal with that. And then some trips maybe don't send the kid home, but once the students are home, they go through the administrative review and disciplinary system, you know, as if that incident had just occurred. So
and I mean, it's one of, that must be one, I'm sure that's one of the things in your behavioral code that
yes, like, you have to lay that out ahead of time and you have to make sure the parents understand and sign that, like, it's going to be at their expense. So I think that's just an important thing with travel nowadays. Like, you don't want to have your school or your program be saddled with that expense. You want that expense to be from the families.
Yeah.
If something were to happen, that was really a negative.
Yeah.
A negative thing. Yeah.
I liked when you were talking about fundraising, that fundraising is sort of a ensemble building opportunity. What kind of fundraising, how long, like, do you start fundraising, like, right in September? Do you do it, like, for the whole year? What kind of events do you do? And how much are the students sort of on, what do they take on?
So we had to do a lot of fundraising for our Edinburgh Fringe Festival trips, like, a ton of fundraising. You know, like, $65,000 amount of fundraising. Wow. And for this trip, we were fundraising to pay for a few chaperones and then any extra spending money the kids could raise. So we've done a bunch of different fundraising events over the years, and we're lucky we don't have to fundraise for our program. So my sister is another local drama teacher in New Jersey, but she has to fundraise to support her actual shows. So I think that's what prevents her from taking on travel, is that, oh my gosh, like, I have to fundraise for my choreographer. Like, how could I possibly then fundraise for a trip? Do you know, like, it's a lot of pressure. But what we've found is we sort of take on an idea of, like, every month we're going to have something going on for our trip. So that could be a car wash. That could be, we did a bake sale and a craft sale at the holidays. that was really successful because we had art tied in with our trip. We sort of abused the skills and talents of the art club, where we, you know, we made holiday cards and ornaments and pillows out of our old show t-shirts. So we made sort of secret elf gifts, because there's a lot of those exchanges, you know, with sports teams and on the boarding hall and advisory groups. So we sort of took advantage of that time of year when people are having to pick up small gifts for people. And we just did like a lunchtime sale every day for, I think, like 7 days of school. Another thing we do is we sell a certain number of tickets for our shows, like a guaranteed front row seat or a guaranteed seat on one of the more popular nights at a higher price. So like we did $20 a ticket versus your regular $10 admission price. But then we're keeping all of that money because we don't usually get our ticket money. That's something that sort of goes into the school and it's like part of our budget, I guess. So we do some tie-ins with the shows, like our concessions. We've had parents with special skills. So this year we had a masseuse, a parent who was a masseuse, and she did chair massages during exam week. So she donated that back to us, but the kids had to organize it. Like the kids had to make the sign-up sheet and do all the publicity and sit at the table and check people in and make sure people showed up on time. So the kids, you know, take on a lot of responsibility. And basically, like, our philosophy is, like, we can sort of help you as the student group, like, set it up and get it going. But if it's really coming down to people not signing up to work shifts or not baking things, like, we're just not going to sell. You know, like, we're not going to – I'm not going to stay up until 2 o'clock in the morning making brownies, like – If the students aren't doing it, we're not doing it. Like the fundraising event is canceled or put on hold. One of the best events we ever did, actually we have two really great big events that we've done with great success. One was a yard sale, which is a marginal pain in the butt, but it's a great money maker if you're in a place like we are in Central New Jersey where people are just obsessed with yard sales. So I don't know if that would work with every community, but with where we are, the interest of people in like finding treasures and fixing them up, that's something that's sort of part of the culture here in Central New Jersey. So the yard sale has been awesome. And then we also did a spinning event. So the spin classes at the gym we did, and now you can do such great fundraising online. So we had every student had a page of a sponsorship for the spinning. And then we had two faculty members who did, instead of spin for Scotland, they did sit for Scotland, where they sat on a couch in the spinning room. Like burgers and fries and like food being delivered. And they literally sat there grading papers. And they earned us the most money. Like they had so many people support them because people thought it was hilarious. It wasn't so hilarious to us on the bikes, but like they earned a lot of money for us. So we actually earned $21,000 for 3 hours of spinning.
Holy because smokes.
Because every kid and every family had a fundraising page. So like I had people that I went to high school with, like through Facebook or whatever, see that I was doing this and give me $15. You know, like it was crazy because nowadays with Kickstarter and all those things, it's so easy to reach a huge amount of people. And if everybody in your sort of friend community, your social media friend community is giving you $5, $10, $15, that's a lot of money. You know, if you have 24 or 28 people involved in your travel group. So my sister does something, and I know some other colleagues of mine in drama, you know, other drama teachers hook up with collegiate stadium and you can sell food and get paid a certain amount for working games, and that's a lucrative fundraising thing that schools can do easily also.
I think that the thing is that that's really sounding is that multiple events with small. So, you know, like you're like, hey, this is $1. Hey, this is $5. Hey, I use social, and that over the long haul is going to really suit you well.
Yes. And I think if you like, what we've found is if we do something once a month, the school is sort of aware, like the other kids at school are aware, like, oh, the London trip. I remember like last month they were selling holiday cards. Okay, now they're doing Valentine's, or now they're doing exam massages, or now it's time for the musical, so they're selling tickets. Like, it's a good like memory jog for the community, and it doesn't get to a point where people are sick of hearing from us.
Yeah.
'Cause some other groups that I've known over the years at school that like they're trying to do something every Friday, or they're trying, it's just too much. Like, and then people get turned off, you know? And I think if you are clear with why you're fundraising, you know, like we're not fundraising for the kids' trips necessarily. We're fundraising for our production expenses. We're fundraising for chaperones so that families aren't paying for chaperones out of pocket. We're fundraising so that we can, you know, earn the money to get the coach bus to go visit our sister school. Like, so we try to be pretty specific about why we're asking for money from the community.
I think that's
Just so
important.
that people
People want to know.
understand.
People want to know.
Yeah, they want to know where their money's going, so.
Cool. Awesome. Oh, I think we could talk on this all day, but
I know.
you've way past your allotted
Yes.
time. It's really wonderful. So as we wrap up here, what are three pieces of advice that you would give to teachers when it comes to traveling with students?
I think you want to have a good team of chaperones. You want to have chaperones who have good instincts, who have different skills. So you might want a chaperone that's like really good at getting kids to follow the rules. You might want a chaperone that's really organized with like spreadsheets and checklists. And you may want a chaperone who's like more laid back. You know, you want people that are going to complement your skills and strengths and weaknesses as a chaperone so that the kids sort of have that nice balance of like, you know, expectations, but understanding and nurturing, because they are away from home and you get tired and you need sort of a blend of like, you want to check in on time, but you also want to be understanding if somebody's upset or needs a little bit of extra. And then you want to have sort of different modes of organization on your team. So I think having a good blend of chaperones is really important. I think meeting with parents and having your finger on the pulse of parental expectations in addition to your students is important. And then I guess finally, one thing we do pretty successfully with our trips at our school is that there should be a reflection or some kind of follow-up or a sharing with the community after the trip. So we're actually going to try to do like a display of maybe artwork inspired. We did do our show before we left because we were doing a show at the school over there. And we did that show before we left, but we're actually doing the show again tomorrow for the middle schoolers. And so hopefully we can get some feedback and be able to share a little bit with them about our traveling. But I think if you can share with the community about your experience and why it was enriching, it sort of then opens doors for more groups to try to travel and have that experience for themselves.
That is fantastic. That is awesome advice. Lisa, you've just been, thank you so much for sharing your expertise. It's been really great talking to you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Lisa. Before we go, let's do some theater folk news. It's a play feature. It's a play feature. It's time to feature a play. Today it is a brand new play in the Theater Folk catalog called Finishing Sentences by Scott Giesler. The main character, Kendra, she has been arrested, right? She has vandalized a classmate's car. There's criminal harassment. There's a restraining order. And to make amends for this, she has to do time through community service. And that community service is working at a camp. And she is completely resistant, sarcastic. She's flawed. And that's one of the things I want to emphasize about the greatness of this play is we have a flawed main character. So much more interesting than to watch than someone who has all the answers. So in Finishing Sentences, we've got someone who has to finish literally a sentence, but also they have a lot of trouble finishing verbal sentences, meaning getting out what actually is going on in her mind and what has been happening to her. So we got a great main character, and you've also got great theatricality. It's sort of a surreal summer camp as we get to see what's going on inside of Kendra's head. That's the amazing thing about theater, is that we can see what people are actually thinking, and we get insight into her behavior. At the same time, the campers are making s'mores. See, I love it when realism, when something, a very little bit gritty story gets combined with quirkiness. I think that's a real interesting balance to play. And this play, Finishing Sentences, does it so well. So you can read sample pages from Finishing Sentences at theaterfolk.com, or you can find the link in the show notes, theaterfolk.com, episode 162. Don't forget the / in there. Finally, where can you find this podcast? We post new episodes every second Tuesday at theaterfolk.com and on our Facebook page and Twitter. You can find us on youtube.com/theaterfolk and on the Stitcher app. You can subscribe to TFP on iTunes. All you have to do is search for the word theaterfolk. And that's where we're going to end. Take care, my friends. Take care.